I'm Tommy McNeil. Hurricane Florence has been downgraded to a tropical storm. It has left at least five people dead after it made landfall in the southeastern U.S. state of North Carolina. Roy Cooper is North Carolina's governor.
Swift water rescue teams and other first responders have rescued hundreds of people in New Bern. Teams from local areas, other states, and the Coast Guard are responding to calls for help, and they are conducting searches of the flooded areas.
The U.S. Hurricane Center predicts as much as 101 centimeters of rain for some parts of North Carolina. After pleading guilty to federal charges, former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort says he will cooperate with the special counsel's Russia investigation. AP's Warren Levinson.
Washington, D.C. Judge Amy Berman Jackson says Paul Manafort's plea deal requires him to cooperate fully and truthfully with the special counsel's investigation. The former Trump campaign chairman avoided a second trial on charges for financial crimes. He was convicted on 8 counts last month in Virginia. The charges stem from Manafort's work on behalf of a Russian-backed party in Ukraine, not the Trump presidential campaign. And the White House press secretary said in a statement Manafort's decision to plead guilty and cooperate is totally unrelated to the president. He had floated the possibility of a pardon for Manafort after he refused to plead in his first trial. I'm Warren Levinson.
A super typhoon is dumping rain and destruction in the Philippines. It came ashore earlier with winds of 270 kilometers per hour. At least two people have been killed as a result of a landslide. Weather forecasters do predict that the storm will head toward Hong Kong and southern China by Monday. Find more at voanews.com. This is VOA News. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg says he has no intention of backing down in the face of a resurgent Russia, insisting the Western alliance will hold firm.
America's NATO allies employed tens of thousands of intelligence personnel, giving the United States better eyes and better ears.
Tensions between Russia and the West have been rising steadily in recent years. Investigators are trying to pinpoint the cause of a fiery natural gas explosion in some neighborhoods north of Boston. The AP's Ed Donahue reports one person was killed.
Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker got a look at the damage to homes in the Lawrence area.
If you look at the way that chimney came over, I mean, that thing is huge, and it just crumbled.
As many as 8,000 people were displaced. Some of the aging gas pipeline system dates back to the 1860s. The mayor of Lawrence, Dan Rivera, blames the gas company.
The least informed and the last to act has been Columbia Gas.
No final determination has been made, but the Massachusetts Emergency Management Agency blamed the explosions on gas lines that had become overpressurized. I'm Ed Donahue.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says the enforcement of United Nations sanctions on North Korea is critical. He took aim at Moscow in remarks to reporters.
Russia has actively attempted to undermine the U.N. Security Council resolutions, the work of the 1718 Committee, the committee at the U.N. that evaluates compliance with sanctions by attempting to change the language there.
His remarks came after the U.S. accused Russia of altering a U.N. report to cover up Moscow's alleged violation of U.N. sanctions on North Korea. Both Russia and China have pushed for U.N. Security Council to ease the sanctions on Pyongyang. An Afghan military helicopter caught fire late Friday after a crash landing that killed at least five people. The aircraft was traveling to the neighboring province when it crashed, according to officials. The provincial governor's spokesman said the helicopter experienced technical difficulties and was not shot down by the Taliban. The defense ministry said the cause of the crash continues to be investigated. The first inter-Korean summit of 2018 was a sunny spectacle in late April. It reduced war fears on the peninsula. The second was an emergency one in May. It helped ensure a historic meeting between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and President Donald Trump. Now, at his third summit with Kim next week in Pyongyang, South Korean President Moon Jae-in faces his toughest challenge yet. That's delivering something substantive that goes beyond previous vague statements on denuclearization, and also to help get the U.S.-North Korean talks back on track. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotin in Washington.
She was an inmate like others, and she was doing her sentence and trying to be loyal to the prison rules and regulations.
Rwanda releases opposition leader Victoire Ingabire Saturday.
So it's mixed reaction. People are commending her. People are hailing her. But some are still calling for prosecution so that we get to the bottom of the matter.
Nigerian finance minister resigns over allegations of a forged document.
In Uganda, when you expose crime, you are seen as a person committing a crime.
And popular Ugandan lawmaker and musician Bobby Wine plans to return home next week after seeking medical attention in the U.S. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The spokesperson for the Rwandan Correctional Service says Victoire Ingabire, an opposition leader, was released Saturday. Hilary Singambo says the Correctional Service carried out President Paul Kagame's pardon, which led to the release of the opposition leader. His remark came after the president granted mercy to Ingabire, who is the leader of the unregistered opposition United Democratic Forces of Rwanda, Inkinji Party. Ingabire was jailed 15 years for threatening state security and belittling the 1994 genocide. For more about her release, I reached spokesperson Hilary Singambu of the Rwandan Correctional Service in the capital, Kigali.
Yeah, it is just to implement the decision, and today at 9:30, she was set free. This morning, it was done this morning at 9:30. Yeah, it was an order, and we were supposed to implement it, and it is done.
Tell us what process led to to her release after the directive came. What processes led to the release now?
Yeah, first of all, she applied and requested for the pardon. So legally, it is written by her and endorsed by the prison, then submitted to the ministry. Then ministry presented to the president, and it is now granted after. I think 2 months.
So after the president gave the pardon or directive, how long did it take for the prison to process the paperwork to release her today, Saturday?
Yeah, it was immediately gazetted, and we implemented the decision today.
Tell me, how was she like in prison, if I may ask you?
She was an inmate like others, and she was doing her sentence and trying to be loyal to the prison rules and regulation, and that's why even she was also considered as somebody who deserves this.
So she was not a trouble to the prison officers who were handling her, was she?
Not at all. She was loyal to the administration and the up to today, and she was happy this morning when she was released, and thanks to the President of the Republic, Paul Kagame, for have awarded her this presidential grace.
What is the message of the Rwandan Correction Service based on her stay there, the way she conducted herself?
Yeah, we call all the prisoners to behave very well and be loyal to the prison rules and regulations, such as that also can be awarded the same.
Hilary Singambo is the spokesperson for the Rwandan Correctional Service. He spoke with me from Kigali. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has accepted the resignation of Finance Minister Kemi Adeosun. The president has since appointed Zainab Ahmed, the Minister of State Budget and National Planning, to replace Adeosun. This after the finance minister resigned following allegations that she used a forged certificate to avoid participating in the country's mandatory one-year youth service. Some analysts say her resignation is unlikely to cause a ripple effect in Africa's biggest economy. To learn more about the finance minister's resignation, I reach Abdulrahman Balogun, assistant editor-in-chief with the News Agency of Nigeria in the capital, Abuja.
Based on her own explanation, she came back to the country at the age of 34, and then you have the National Youth Service Scheme after your graduation that you have to do 1 year compulsory service to the nation. But once you are 30, you are exempted. In the process of securing the essential certificate, the self certificate, she got a fake one. She's been using that all along. She's 52 now. Until recently, that our certificate was fake.
Well, some people are saying she trusted people who perhaps might not have given her the wrong information, culminating into that. But some are also saying she has been doing so well. She implemented new measures to ensure Nigeria is on a very good economic trajectory. So her fall from grace is quite worrying. What are you hearing on the ground?
Yes, I agree with you 100% on that. Professionally, you cannot fault her. She has been doing her work diligently. She moved up after the session due to her economic progress. I think you cannot fault her on that. She's been wonderful. I mean, she's just profiting for this kind of thing. And on her own position, she's fine.
Some are saying because she came out cleaned house in the economic sector, some people were sacked. There were a whole lot of ghost names that were removed from the government payroll. So she might have stepped on the wrong toes, which ensured a significant backlash, forcing her to resign. What is your take?
From that perspective, she has stepped on so many toes. There's no way you do such an economic reform in this our complex country, Nigeria, that you not step on toes. She was in the forefront of saying all the billionaires must pay tax. Billionaires in Nigeria only pay their correct tax. She ensured that they put in the policy in place to ensure that they pay their taxes. It does not go that well with them. So many other things. Of course, the one just mentioned about the payroll. Of course, you remember the issue of TSC. And so many other online issues. So many of these economic reforms that have been working well and saving Nigeria some necessary refugees. There's no way you can work in that terrain. I will not step on toes. Of course, we have. So she has to pay. That's the price.
How are Nigerians reacting to this news, particularly when the president has made fighting corruption a significant portion of his mandate?
Of course, we are hailing our colleagues, for allowing the rule of law I'm saying now, and then just to enhance the integrity of the present administration. People are hailing our decision to step down, so that, in fact, some Nigerians see present further that she should be prosecuted, or those who gave that fake certificate to be prosecuted to the end of this matter. So it's a trial for the government, and it's a mixed reaction, really. People are hailing her. If I just say she's a victim of circumstance in this case, the lesson being learned is that the team needs some reform, especially the system. Anybody can procure, they call it Oluwole document. Anybody can be a victim of Oluwole document. We have people procuring fake driver's license, fake international passports, fake documents like that. So many people have been falling, fake certificates, school certificates, degree certificates. They are all about, you can be a victim, everybody can be a victim, until when such an individual is discriminated. So it's mixed reaction. People are commending her. People are hearing her. But some are still calling for prosecution so that we get to the bottom of the matter.
Abdulrahman Balogun is the assistant editor-in-chief with the News Agency of Nigeria. He spoke with me from Abuja. Popular Ugandan lawmaker and musician Bobby Wine says he plans to return home next week. This despite concerns that the government would prevent him from returning home after seeking medical attention in the U.S. The parliamentarian says he was tortured by soldiers from the Ugandan People's Defense Force, or UPDF, after he was charged with illegal possession of guns and ammunition. The UPDF denies the accusation. The parliamentarian was in the VOA studios where I caught up with him to find out more about his plans to return home after seeking medical attention here in the U.S.
Well, there's no that prevents me from returning to Uganda. And besides, if I don't return to Uganda, where do they expect me to go? I have only one nationality, that's Uganda. I have only one country, one home, and that's Uganda. So no matter what or who the guy is, nobody can stop me from going back to Uganda.
So what were the circumstances that led to your delay? Because you were scheduled to fly out, you were taken off, you were prevented from traveling, and then they released you after a day. What happened?
Yeah, the police arrested me from the airport. They did not give any explanation. They beat me in the police ambulance. They dumped me in a hospital and locked me in a room with my wife. But after a day and a half, they released me without explanation and told me, now I can leave the country.
But the government stated that they wanted to check you out first at a public hospital to ensure that the accusations your supporters were leveling against the government that you were tortured are false.
But they never checked me.
They never did?
They never checked me.
So you said you were tortured when you went to campaign. Some of your supporters are saying you've gone 4-0 in campaigning for opponents of President Museveni in parliament, and that you are an existential threat. Hence, the decision for the government to prevent you from causing disaffection and creating instability in the country. How do you respond to such criticisms?
Everybody who says the truth is seen as a threat to President Museveni. In Uganda, when you expose crime, you are seen as a person committing a crime. That is where we are. Our president is so paranoid now because he knows he has been in power for 32 years. He knows he's leading a country that he's so disconnected with. He's too old and we're so young and is completely out of connection with us. So he has every reason to be paranoid.
But he said evidence he had was that you were not tortured and that reports of your torture were just mere allegations, they were unfounded, and that you should provide proof of that torture.
Well,
and that if it's proven that you were not tortured, he demands an apology from you and your supporters.
You see, President Museveni has proved himself to be a chronic liar. This is somebody who lies with impunity.
But that's difficult to say, to prove, because he said he has empirical evidence that you were not tortured.
Well, you are with me in the studio. You're looking at my hands. You're seeing them peel, right? You're looking at my eyes. You're looking at the scars. And besides that, the Uganda Human Rights Commission came to the military incarceration where I was held, and they saw me. All of them broke down and cried. All of them. And indeed, they wrote a report. A report was seen. I was examined by the military doctors. I was examined by the prison doctors, and I was examined by the doctors in Rubaga Hospital after I got released from prison. All reports are shown. And besides, I was flown on a doctor's advice because I had to get specialized treatment. I've been getting treatment in America. So whatever the president is saying he should be ashamed of.
Well, you are here. Some NRM supporters are saying you are here and tarnishing the reputation of Uganda. And that when you come, you have to be made to face the full rigors of the law for tarnishing the reputation of Uganda, which is a democratic country with a president that was legitimately elected by the people of Uganda. What say you?
Whatever I'm doing, if it's tarnishing, it's tarnishing the reputation of Museveni and not Uganda. Okay? Uganda are the Ugandans and not a person. And yes, if there's a law that blocks me from saying the truth, if there's a law that blocks me from exposing torture, I am ready to face that law because I'm going back to Uganda next week and I know they're listening to me. Guys, wait for me. I'm coming back home.
What's next for you as you return to Uganda?
Exactly what I've been doing. I'm going to start exactly where I stopped. I am going to continue the fight for liberty and freedom. And like I said before, we are going to win that struggle or we shall die trying.
Bobby Wine is a Ugandan parliamentarian and musician. He spoke with me from here in the VOA studios in Washington, D.C. The Malawian National Election System Trust, or NEST, has expressed concern that only a few political parties are monitoring the ongoing voter registration process being carried out by the Electoral Commission. This after a survey conducted by the National Election Systems showed that the ruling Democratic Progressive Party, or DPP, and the main opposition Malawi Congress Party, MCP, are the only groups having their representatives monitoring the voter registration process. The Electoral Commission is compiling a voter list to be used for next year's general election. To learn more about the survey, I reach Yunandi Banda, Executive Director for the National Election Systems Trust.
Most of the polling centers, you could see the evidence and the physical presence of monitors from Democratic Progressive Party and Malawi Congress Party, MCP. Now, to ask where are the other political parties, where are their monitors, the answer I was getting from the registering officials was, we cannot force them to send their monitors around here. Only these two parties that have sent the monitors to all our registration centers. Now, to us as a body that is looking at the preparedness and seriousness of the elections in 2019, we have concluded that really the two political parties, MCP and DPP, are the ones who have invested a lot of energies and resources into the preparation for the 2019 elections.
There is this growing buzz about the UTM and former President Joyce Banda's PP party. Now, do you think that they could have any impact in next year's election based on the phases of registration that you've observed so far?
The two political parties you have mentioned, yes, they do have the support, but when we talk of an electoral process, you have to invest in it so that at the end of the day, you have to be there in all the activities of the process. So I believe very strongly that if the two parties are going to put up a grand presence at the end of the process, then they should not question the figures of the voters, where or how the voting process will be like, because it is important that a serious contender has to invest in the whole preparation of the process.
Usually, opposition parties and sometimes ruling parties across Africa accuse the Electoral Commission of manipulating figures or the outcome of elections. Based on what you have seen so far, is there any chance of these political parties who are not being part of this process raising issues about the credibility of the election if elections were to be organized next year?
They could raise such concerns, but at the end of the day, The whole process is being observed very closely by many local organizations in the country, and we are all satisfied that the registration is going on well, and possibly where there are challenges, we believe that the problems will be sorted out, and those areas where people did not register in good numbers, the Electoral Commission has promised that it will evaluate the whole exercise at the end of registration and see which districts have registered below this threshold. So far, it's Blanta and Kasungu, the two, have registered numbers below the threshold of the Electoral Commission.
When your organization engaged those political parties not participating in monitoring the process so far, what was the response you got?
The response I got was that the resources and the political parties do not have enough resources that could be utilized in the monitoring of the registration process.
Will this lack of resources possibly undermine their chances?
What you're saying is quite obvious and correct, but they have really said that they don't have enough resources that can enable them to deploy two monitors at each and every polling center. But they have said that maybe during the polling day, they will manage to engage such monitors to observe the polling activities from morning to the counting time.
Yunandi Banda is the executive director for the Malawian National Election System Trust. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Blantyre. Gambian President Adama Barrow says the country's unprecedented youth unemployment rate has contributed to the high influx of illegal youth migration to Europe over the years. The International Organization for Migration reported that over 5,400 Gambians traveled to Italy through the back way to Europe this past year. But Barrow says plans are afoot to arrest the scourge with the intervention of the European Union and other development partners. For VOA, Pandere Mbaye has more.
President Adama Barrow addressed Parliament on Thursday, where he highlighted the country's gloomy future as far as youth unemployment and illegal migration to Europe are concerned. Barrow notes that youth unemployment is becoming one of the main driving forces behind illegal migration.
The youth make up the largest proportion of the Gambian population. 36.7% of 1.8 million Gambian population are aged 13 to 30 years, yet youth unemployment has risen to 38%. I made reference to this earlier, and it is cause for concern for all of us. My government inherited extremely wide-ranging socio-economic challenges. These include acute frustration and lack of opportunities for the youth. The result is that thousands of youth undertake risky journeys.
Thousands of youths have died over the years as a result of illegal migration to Europe. President Barrow told Parliament that the Gambia's donor partners have responded to appeals to help arrest the illegal cross-border migration.
Implementation of the 11 million euro youth empowerment project from the European Trust Fund is ongoing. The overall objective of this four-year project is to tackle the economic root causes of irregular migration through increased job opportunities and income prospects for the youth.
Barrow says the Gambian government has partnered with the International Labour Organization in collaboration with the Japanese government to support the establishment of a $3.9 million project on employment creation for youth to build sustainable peace in the Gambia. He also says the EU-funded project on preventing illegal migration is having a positive impact on the lives of the youths.
The project has trained over 1,000 youngsters in various skills within 1 year. This is complemented by the $14 million skills for youth employment fund launched this year. We aim to equip another 1,000 Gambian youths with relevant technical and vocational skills in partnership with local training institutions.
Barrow describes illegal migration as a source of much concern and Greece. He says his government has formulated a new migration policy that would help reinforce Gambia's Immigration Act, especially as regards to cross-border movement. For VOA Africa, this is Pan Derimbai reporting.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, media groups in Cameroon have accused the country's National Communication Council of censorship ahead of October's presidential election. This after it issued a stern warning accusing media groups of propagating hate language that can deepen fighting in the Central African country. For VOA Moki, Edwin Kenzeka reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
Le 7 octobre, peuple camerounais, tu as le choix de construire le Cameroun violent.
This is Amplitude FM, a radio station in Cameroon's capital Yaoundé, asking potential voters to be ready for the carnage that will spread all over the Central African state should the leader Paul Biya be re-elected October 7. The broadcaster says that after 36 years as head of state, Biya should peacefully hand over power and, if not, be forced to do so. The radio program is called Polymètre. Less than a month ago, its presenter Dieudonné Mba anchored another political program called Polyfocus that was suspended by Cameroon's National Communication Council, NCC, the country's media regulator, for spreading hate language. He simply changed the name of the program. Mba says his program, like 12 others, was targeted because it takes a strong stance against President Biya's long stay in power. He says if he should be punished for asking people to vote for change, so too should other journalists for asking potential voters to take a tougher stand against those who oppose Biya.
So media houses like the state-owned CRTV, television stations which are owned or backed by government ministers seem untouched even when their journalists are known to have breaking same rules which other journalists and other media organs have been punished before, but they go unpunished. So I think that the NCC still needs to rise to that occasion where they can discipline any media houses irrespective of the name or irrespective of who owns it.
Jude Kiven, president of the Yaoundé chapter of the Association of English-Speaking Journalists, says politicians have manipulated many journalists who now no longer practice their profession but take sides with some candidates. Jude says many producers of programs suspended by the NCC simply change their names or the names of the media organ.
It is important for the National Communication Council to sanction anyone or any media house that is guilty of hate speech. Yeah, the National Communication Council can take decisions and sanctions that can be ignored by the journalists or the media house. Government did not give the National Communication Council enough powers to be able to enforce their decisions.
Last month, a court in Yaoundé asked the president of the NCC, Peter Esoka, to pay a fine of $30,000 as damages to Vision 4, a TV station in Cameroon. Esoka had suspended some of the station's programs, saying they could be compared with those of Radio Mille Collines, the media outlet that was at the heart of the 1994 genocide in Rwanda. Esoka acted after journalists from Vision 4 said all English speakers in the bilingual country, where French also is an official language, should be held responsible and punished for the crisis rocking the English-speaking northwest and southwest regions. Private media outlets in Cameroon also defied a ban on political programs imposed by the National Communication Council, which insisted political debates may cause conflicts ahead of senatorial elections on March 25. In 2017, the NCC suspended 35 journalists and media outlets, accusing them of failing to respect professional norms and ethics. Some of those punished had criticized the government's handling of the crisis in the English-speaking regions. Others criticized senior state functionaries about the use of public funds. Esoka says the NCC is against journalists and media organs that propagate hate language, and he called on the people to revolt if the candidates the people seemingly support are not elected.
It has been so insulting, abusive. It's becoming rampant, developing into a hate society. We cannot permit that some people destroy the state of a nation under the pretext that they are free. Freedom or liberty has its limits, and we shall insist on those limits. Part of the crisis in our country is based on the kinds of things that people say.
Esoka says the NCC is committed to cleaning up the media landscape in Cameroon, but it doesn't have a way to enforce decisions and must rely on administrative and security officials who very often refuse to collaborate. Esoka said he regrets that media rights group Reporters Without Borders thinks the NCC is taking a tougher line towards journalists and media. Cameroon was ranked 126 out of 180 countries in the Reporters Without Borders 2016 World Press Freedom Index. Cameroon has more than 500 newspapers and 100 radio and TV stations that express divergent views about the presidential election. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
And right now it's time for music from our African collection. Yo wako muta usakande tisati.
Kawo koyo musoko nan labule wera kanto.
Hey,
mani saralale ganuna ya anganu mana ako ibanye dongili lala nyalala ganume anganu mana ako ibanye dongili lala nyalala ganune yala anganu mana ako ibanye polibala nyafola ganune anganu mana ako ibanye kitari fola nyafola sirile ya shana anganu mana ako ibanye piano fola nyafola ganune lala anganu mana ako ibanye jeme fola nyafola sirile ya
That was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, producer Saida Hamdoun and our engineer for today, Patrick Day, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. I remember, as the elders say, if you cure the toothache of a monkey, it will use it to visit your farm. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The enduring defeat of ISIS remains a top priority for the United States.
The U.S.-led Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS is leading stabilization efforts that consolidate military gains, restore basic essential services, and enable Syrians to voluntarily and safely return to their homes in Raqqa and other former ISIS strongholds. Assistance includes explosive hazard and rubble removal, providing clean water, rehabilitating electricity networks, and other basic necessities. Since April, the United States has elicited approximately $300 million in contributions and pledges from coalition partners to support immediate stabilization and early recovery initiatives in areas liberated from ISIS in northeast Syria, including a generous contribution of $100 million by Saudi Arabia and $50 million by the United Arab Emirates. As a result of these generous contributions and other factors, State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert announced the U.S. will redirect $230 million in stabilization funds for Syria, which have been under review. This decision does not represent any lessening of U.S. commitment to our strategic goals in Syria, stressed Ms. Nauert. President Donald Trump has made clear that the U.S. is prepared to remain in Syria until the enduring defeat of ISIS, and the U.S. remains focused on ensuring the withdrawal of Iranian forces and their proxies. "We believe," said Ms. Nauert, "that neither of these events will happen without irreversible progress toward a political resolution of the conflict, in accordance with U.N. Security Council Resolution 2254. This decision does not affect U.S. humanitarian assistance. The United States is the largest single humanitarian donor for the Syrian response, providing more than $8.6 billion in humanitarian assistance since the start of the crisis for those displaced inside Syria and the region. The U.S. will also continue to work with its international partners towards the achievement of a peaceful resolution of the Syrian conflict under a UN-led political process. The Syrian people deserve a country free of war, human rights abuses, and terrorism."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
This is